Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Real Talk About Influenza Vaccine Safety, Be Informed and Be Prepared, which is certified by Medscape CME and presented by William L. Atkinson, MD, MPH, Karen R. Broder, MD, and Timothy M. Uwicki, MD, MPH, MPP. Dr. Atkinson is a medical epidemiologist, National Center for Immunology and Respiratory Disease, U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Atkinson has disclosed no relevant financial relationships. Dr. Atkinson does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Atkinson does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Broder is a team lead, Surveillance and Public Health Response Team, Immunization Safety Office, U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Broder has disclosed no relevant financial relationships. Dr. Broder does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Broder does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Uwicki is a medical epidemiologist, Influenza Division, U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Uwicki has disclosed no relevant financial relationships. Dr. Uwicki does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Uwicki does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to educate clinicians on the following topics: the safety profiles of licensed influenza vaccines, the safe administration of influenza vaccines, and screening for contraindications and precautions. The resources available for communicating benefits and risks of influenza vaccination, and the accurate and timely reporting of any adverse events to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. This activity is supported by a contract from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Immunization Safety Office. To participate in the CME activity, please go to cme.medscape.com/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, my name is William Atkinson. I'm a medical epidemiologist in the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I'd like to welcome you to this Medscape Spotlight, Real Talk About Influenza Vaccine Safety, Be Informed and Be Prepared. This activity is supported by an educational grant from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Joining me today are my colleagues, Dr. Tim Uwicki and Dr. Karen Broder. Dr. Tim Uwicki is a medical epidemiologist in the Epidemiology and Prevention Branch, Influenza Division at the CDC. Dr. Karen Broder is a medical officer in the Immunization Safety Office, Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion at the CDC. Here are the learning objectives for this program. Apply the updated Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices recommendations for influenza immunization. Separate fact from fiction about vaccine safety. And demonstrate appropriate use of the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or VAERS. Dr. Uwicki will begin our program with a brief review of the burden and impact of influenza in the United States and recommendations for use of the 2010-2011 seasonal influenza vaccine. Tim.
Thanks, Bill. So every year in the United States, in the fall, the winter, and the spring, we have epidemics of seasonal influenza, and they vary in terms of their severity. Sometimes we have mild seasons and sometimes more severe seasons. We have an average of more than 200,000 influenza-related hospitalizations each year, and the highest hospitalization rate is in persons aged 65 years and older. But there are also high rates of hospitalization in persons with chronic illness, children who are less than 2 years of age, and children who are aged 2 to 5 years of age. In terms of deaths, there's an estimate of anywhere from about 3,300 to 48,000 influenza-associated deaths per year. And the vast majority of these, 90% or more, are in persons aged 65 years and older. There's an estimate of about 124 deaths in children each year in the United States. But during the 2003 through 2007 influenza seasons in the U.S., we've had anywhere from 46 up to 153 pediatric influenza-associated deaths reported to CDC per year. In terms of hospitalizations, this figure illustrates that the vast majority of hospitalizations, the highest hospitalization rates, occurs in persons age 65 and older. In terms of deaths, again, the vast majority of influenza-associated deaths in terms of mortality rate, the biggest impact is in people 65 years and older. During this past season, the 2009-2010 season, more than 99% of all the influenza virus strains that were identified in the U.S. were characterized as 2009 H1N1 virus. This was the pandemic virus. And the epidemiology of severe disease with pandemic influenza is different than the epidemiology of seasonal influenza. What we saw was an age shift to young children and young adults. And the hospitalization rates during the pandemic were highest among young children. They were high in school-age children, and they were high in non-elderly adults, persons less than 65 years in age. And the mortality rates were also highest in adults less than 65 years of age. Now, the majority of hospitalizations and deaths occurred among persons who had chronic underlying medical conditions, but we also saw a big impact in terms of pregnancy. So women in their second and third trimesters of pregnancy and up to 2 weeks postpartum were at especially higher risk of severe outcomes of pandemic influenza. We also saw that people who are morbidly obese, persons who have neuromuscular conditions, persons with underlying chronic pulmonary disease such as asthma, and people who were in indigenous groups, so American Indians, Native Alaskans, these were groups that were greatly impacted in terms of severe outcomes with pandemic influenza. Now, in terms of hospitalization rates, what this figure shows is that compared to three previous influenza seasons, the two highest lines on each of these graphs shows for each age group that the hospitalization rates for pandemic influenza in terms of population-based surveillance, these were higher for pandemic influenza except for persons 65 years and older. We did not see such an impact in elderly persons. In terms of deaths, we've been monitoring since 2003-2004 the numbers of children who die of influenza-associated conditions in the U.S. This is a nationally notifiable disease. And during the 2009-2010 season, we had 281 cases of influenza-associated pediatric deaths reported to CDC. There were more than 300 since the beginning of the pandemic. This is a much bigger impact in terms of pediatric deaths than we observed during seasonal epidemics in the U.S. Now, because most people don't get tested, we have to do these estimates using modeling studies. And so CDC has performed these modeling studies, and we estimate that there have been at least 61 million illness cases in the United States during the pandemic, resulting in an estimate of 274,000 hospitalizations and about 12,500 deaths. And the majority of the cases of severe disease, so hospitalizations and deaths, were estimated to occur in children and non-elderly adults, so adults less than 65 years of age. And again, this is much different than the epidemiology of seasonal influenza. Recent influenza activity throughout the world, we have seen co-circulation of seasonal influenza A H3N2 virus, influenza B virus, and 2009 H1N1 virus strains in the southern hemisphere, in tropical countries, and subtropical countries. And during the past several months in the U.S., we have had identification of seasonal influenza A, H3N2, influenza B, and 2009 H1N1 virus strains all recently detected in the U.S. And the good news is that of the recently detected 2009 H1N1 strains, these remain antigenically similar as during the pandemic. So when the virus emerged to become a pandemic virus, it has not changed antigenically very much. We expect that to happen in the future, but we don't know when. Now, it's pretty clear that the best way to prevent influenza is through annual influenza vaccination. And this season, annual influenza vaccination is recommended for every person in the United States age 6 months and older. The vaccine is a trivalent vaccine. It contains three strains. It contains an H1N1 strain, which is the same strain that was contained in the monovalent 2009 H1N1 vaccine. It also contains an H3N2 virus strain and an influenza B strain. So again, three strains in the seasonal influenza vaccine. This vaccine is available in an inactivated preparation as well as in a live attenuated preparation. The inactivated vaccine is available for intramuscular administration to persons age 6 months and older. We have both a standard dose form for persons age 6 months and older, as well as a high-dose vaccine that's approved for persons 65 years and older. And we also have a live attenuated vaccine for intranasal administration, and this is only for healthy, non-pregnant persons aged 2 through 49 years of age. Now, even though influenza vaccination is recommended for all persons aged 6 months and older in the United States, there are priority groups who are targeted for vaccination because they are at higher risk for influenza complications. And these include children aged 6 months through 4 years of age, adults 50 years and older, and persons with chronic medical conditions. For example, pulmonary conditions such as asthma, cardiovascular disease, excluding hypertension, renal, hepatic, neurologic, hematologic, metabolic conditions, including diabetes mellitus. It also includes persons who are or will be pregnant during influenza season. It includes persons aged 6 months through 18 years who are on long-term aspirin therapy because of the risk of RISE syndrome if they are to develop influenza. Clearly, persons who are residents of nursing homes or long-term care facilities are a high-risk group and are targeted for influenza vaccination. And this year, we are introducing two new priority groups, and those are American Indian or Alaska Native populations, as well as persons who are morbidly obese. That refers to a body mass index of 40 or greater. Now, there are also additional priority groups. Every single healthcare provider in the United States is recommended for annual influenza vaccination. We also recommend vaccinating household contacts and caregivers of children who are aged less than 5 years or adults 50 years and older, and with particular emphasis on vaccinating contacts of very young children, aged less than 6 months, because these children are not approved for vaccination. Vaccination is only approved for 6 months and older. We also recommend vaccinating household contacts, caregivers of persons with medical conditions that put them at higher risk for severe complications from influenza. So the CDC puts out annual influenza guidance. We put out the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices annual recommendations on the use of influenza vaccine. This is available online on our web pages. It's published as a recommendations and reports in the MMWR.
Tim, we've received a lot of questions, both from clinicians and the public, who seem to be overly concerned about the H1N1 component. There seems to be this perception that the vaccine, that particular part of the vaccine, was tested or produced differently than other parts. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, thanks, Bill. It's a great question. So the production, the development, the production of the monovalent 2009 H1N1 vaccine was the same kind of manufacturing process, the same kind of approval process, same kind of safety and immunogenicity studies were performed as for seasonal influenza vaccine. And so there's nothing new about the manufacturing process. So the seasonal influenza vaccine for this season does contain the 2009 H1N1 antigen in the vaccine, but we're using the same technology as we have for decades, so there's nothing new about it.
We also seem to have a lot of hesitancy about vaccinating pregnant women. What might we be able to do better? What might be convincing to help get better vaccination coverage in that particular group?
You know, clearly pregnant women are a high-risk group for complications of influenza, and we saw a huge impact on pregnant women during the pandemic. But for seasonal influenza, clearly pregnant women are definitely a high-risk group for complications. Now, vaccination of a pregnant woman can protect the pregnant woman from these complications, but also provides additional benefits to the infant. And there are some recent studies that have demonstrated that vaccination of influenza vaccination during pregnancy can actually protect the infant from influenza out to 6 months of life. And as you know, infants less than 6 months cannot be vaccinated for influenza. So as a strategy to protect these young infants up to 6 months, one way is to vaccinate the mother during pregnancy. You get the two for one. You protect the mother and you protect the baby from influenza.
Makes sense. Inactivated vaccine only, right?
Inactivated vaccine only for pregnant women.
Okay, thank you, Tim. Clinicians who provide influenza vaccine frequently receive questions about the safety of these vaccines. Dr. Karen Broder from the CDC Immunization Safety Office will provide a brief overview of influenza vaccine safety. Karen.
Thank you. You know, as Tim mentioned, Bill, this year we have a universal vaccination program where all people 6 months and older should receive the vaccine unless they have a contraindication to vaccination. And so we're fielding a lot of questions about vaccine safety. And the hope here is that I can provide a little bit of background to help clinicians better understand what we do to monitor the safety of vaccines in this country. So as you know, vaccines licensed in the U.S., including the influenza vaccines, are safe and standards for safety are quite high. However, vaccines, like any medical product, can carry some risk. And we know that vaccine safety monitoring and communication about vaccine safety is a really important part of our influenza vaccination program. As Tim mentioned, the routes of administration are different for the inactivated vaccine, which is given by a shot in the arm, usually, or the leg for a young child. And the live attenuated influenza vaccine is given through the nasal route. And so they have different safety profiles, as might make sense to a clinician. The most common reaction after the flu shot or inactivated vaccine is an injection site reaction, like pain at the injection site. And the most common reaction after the live attenuated vaccine is nasal congestion or runny nose. Although I suspect you and Tim have both heard clinicians say that their patients tell them that they got the flu after the shot or their child got the flu after the shot, we know it's not possible for this to happen after the flu vaccine. Rarely, as with other vaccines or medical products, a person can have a severe allergic reaction to the influenza vaccine. And so influenza vaccines should not be given to persons if they had a severe allergic reaction to a previous influenza vaccine, if they have a severe allergic reaction to eggs because vaccines are manufactured using eggs, or if they have a severe allergic reaction history to another component of the influenza vaccine, unless they've consulted with an allergist about this issue. Many partners work together because we know vaccine safety is so important to ensure that vaccines are as safe as possible in this country. So now let's take a step back and look a little bit at how we assess vaccine safety before and after licensure. As Tim mentioned earlier, before vaccine licensure, vaccines are studied quite extensively. They're studied in the lab, in animals, in people, to make sure they are both safe and efficacious. And the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, reviews all this information and makes decisions about licensure. After vaccines are licensed, CDC and FDA both share responsibility for monitoring the safety of vaccines. And you might ask why we need to keep monitoring after licensure, and the reason is because this is the time where it's very important to detect very rare adverse events, because studies done before licensure don't have enough numbers to detect those very rare unexpected adverse events that might occur. So let's talk a little bit more about our approach to vaccine safety monitoring and what we mean when we say the term adverse event or AE. An adverse event, the way we just use it, means that it's an undesirable health outcome that occurs after vaccination. And there are really two reasons why an adverse event might occur after vaccination. It could be caused by the vaccine itself or the vaccination process, or it may be occurring after vaccination by chance. And we all know, especially during flu season, that every day people get sick, and sometimes people will get sick or have a heart attack or another, you know, bad thing happen to them around the time of influenza vaccination. And so one of the challenges in the vaccine safety monitoring effort is to distinguish these situations, and we devote time to doing that. So we start by looking closely for a signal, which is basically a suggestion, just a suggestion, that there might be a concern of an adverse event occurring after vaccine more than what we would expect by chance. And often a signal will come into us in the form of an increased number of reports of a particular adverse event. Next, what we do when we see this happening is we conduct a series of activities to see if the signal is likely just a chance finding. And we call this signal assessment. And then if we continue to have a concern about a signal is verified or ruled out by conducting studies with a proper comparison group to see if there is a risk for an adverse event and the level of risk. And sometimes more than one study is needed to verify or rule out a signal. One of the main goals for monitoring the safety of vaccines, as I mentioned, is to identify those new or rare or unexpected adverse events of clinical importance. And the goals for influenza vaccine safety monitoring are the same as for other vaccines, but there are some special considerations, as Tim knows very well, and you do as well. And these include the fact, as we've talked about, that the formulation changes each year for influenza vaccine. There are three strains, and some years the strains change. There are multiple products from different manufacturers available, both in injection and nasal spray forms. There are maybe new populations recommended to receive influenza vaccine. And in recent years, the vaccine recommendations have expanded to cover more people. And then there's special attention each year to monitor for possible risk of Guillain-Barré syndrome, or GBS, after influenza vaccine. So let's just take a couple of minutes to talk a little bit about that. GBS is a disorder in which the body's immune system attacks the peripheral nervous system. And the concern about GBS after influenza vaccine arose during 1976, when the swine influenza vaccine that year was shown to cause cases of GBS. So since that time, many studies have been conducted looking at possible risk for GBS after influenza vaccine. And the studies of seasonal influenza vaccines in many years have shown either no increased risk for GBS after vaccination, or a very small increased risk of about one additional GBS case after vaccination per million people vaccinated. We use different systems to monitor the safety of vaccines, and one that is especially important to the practicing clinician is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or VAERS. VAERS is co-managed by CDC and FDA, and VAERS encourages reports from healthcare providers of clinically important adverse events after vaccination. VAERS accepts reports from anyone. And what VAERS basically is it's our early warning system for detecting potential vaccine safety concerns. It's important to understand that VAERS, like any system, has strengths, but it also has limitations. And it's really important to understand both. Major strengths of VAERS are that it's national in scope. It covers the whole U.S. It can rapidly detect signals, which, again, are just potential concerns. It can detect very rare adverse events because it covers the whole U.S. population that might not be detected in clinical trials. And it can generate hypotheses or study questions that we can look at further in other systems. Also, your patients and you may be interested to know that VAERS data are available to the public, and this can be accessed through the VAERS website. The main limitations of VAERS are the following. VAERS can have reporting biases, such as underreporting of a particular adverse event if people don't think to report it, or stimulated reporting of an adverse event if there's widespread media attention to this type of event or vaccine. For example, if a story appears in the newspaper about a particular vaccine safety issue, we will sometimes see increased reports in the weeks that follow. VAERS reports have inconsistent data quality and completeness, and as clinicians that report to VAERS, you can contribute to this improving this by making sure that you fill out your form completely. there is not an unvaccinated comparison group. VAERS just accepts reports from people that have adverse events after vaccination or concerns after vaccination. And so most importantly, and this is important to emphasize to your patients if they ask you about VAERS, that VAERS generally cannot determine if a vaccine caused an adverse event. We need to use other systems and do other studies if we have concerns to determine whether a vaccine causes a particular adverse event. I want to talk to you a little bit about a VAERS study that was done. This was done by my colleague, Dr. Claudia Velozzi, who's also a clinician. And she and her colleagues looked at the reports to VAERS in adults across 15 years after receiving the inactivated influenza vaccine before the pandemic. What this study showed is that reporting rates for adverse events after the inactivated influenza vaccine to VAERS were fairly consistent over the time period, and they identified no new concerns. Going into the 2009 H1N1 campaign, there was a lot of attention to vaccine safety. And we had a history of seeing the strong safety profile of influenza vaccines. Because the manufacturing process was the same for the 2009 H1N1 vaccines and the seasonal influenza vaccines, we really expected that the 2009 H1N1 vaccine would have a similar safety profile to the seasonal influenza vaccines, which have that strong track record for safety. And going into the 2009 H1N1 campaign, we had numerous systems in place across the federal government to monitor for vaccine safety, including VAERS. So what I can tell you now is that we've looked at more than 10,000 reports to VAERS after the 2009 H1N1 vaccine, and we can tell you that the safety profile we saw in those reports is quite similar to the safety profile we've seen in reports to VAERS over the last couple of decades. We saw no unexpected patterns or unusual events. And if you'd like to review this information in more detail, it was recently published in the October issue of the medical journal Vaccine. Preliminary data on the safety of the 2009 H1N1 vaccines from other systems used to monitor safety are also being analyzed. And these preliminary data suggest that the safety profile for the 2009 H1N1 vaccine is similar to that of seasonal influenza vaccines. And the final analyses from these studies are underway now. So, you know, as a healthcare provider, and I'm a healthcare provider myself, I'm a pediatrician, I know that we can play a really important role in helping monitor the safety of influenza vaccines. If you have a patient who's received an influenza vaccine and comes to you or calls you at a later date with symptoms that you think are clinically important, we ask that you report that to VAERS. And you should report to VAERS even if you're not sure if the vaccine caused the adverse event. You can submit a report either online, by mail, or by fax. For most vaccines, healthcare providers are required by federal law to report certain conditions after vaccination, and these are listed on the VAERS website. Healthcare providers should also be aware of a program called the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. Persons may seek compensation under this program for certain adverse events after vaccination. It's important, though, to recognize that the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program is separate from VAERS, and reporting an adverse event to VAERS does not file a claim for compensation in the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. So with the new influenza season already upon us, let me close by telling you a little bit about what we're focusing on this year in regard to our safety monitoring. As usual, we have the new annual formulation, which includes three strains, and it contains, as Tim mentioned, the 2009 H1N1 strain, which was used last year. We think it's likely that the 2010-11 influenza vaccine will have a similar safety profile as in the past, but as I mentioned earlier, we need to assess for potential unexpected adverse events, and so that is what we're doing through VAERS and other systems. As Tim mentioned, the ACIP and CDC now recommend a universal vaccination for all persons aged 6 months and older. And this means that we might see more reports to VAERS if more adults are vaccinated than in the past. So it would not surprise me if the number of reports to VAERS after influenza vaccine goes up this year as a reflection of the fact that more people are getting vaccinated. We have the new influenza vaccine called Fluzone High Dose this year, which was licensed for use in adults aged 65 and older, and this is an option for vaccination in this age group. In the pre-licensure trials, the rates of injection site reactions and some constitutional symptoms like fever were higher in persons who received the Fluzone high dose compared with the standard influenza vaccine Fluzone. And these events were typically mild and transient. We expect that the high-dose vaccine will have a similar safety profile to what was seen in the clinical trials and be safe. However, we will monitor this vaccine closely because it is new. So I'd like to just leave you with remembering that studies during the past two decades support the safety of seasonal influenza vaccine with millions of doses safely administered. The data from the 2009-10 season suggest that the safety profile of the 2009 H1N1 vaccine was similar to that of seasonal influenza vaccines, which have a very strong safety record. We have robust safety monitoring in place for the 2010-11 influenza season, and we expect the safety profile will likely be similar to previous seasons. But we're always looking for new concerns, and if we do identify any new concerns, we will communicate this information with healthcare providers and the public and take the action needed to protect the health of the public.
Kara, that's reassuring to know there's so many systems in place. A common question that we get about influenza vaccine safety monitoring in bears is, what kinds of reactions should be reported? Mm-hmm. For instance, people have local reactions. Should those kinds of reactions be routinely reported to bears?
You know, Bill, this is a question that I commonly receive also. And so what we tell clinicians is that they should report clinically important adverse events. They, as clinicians, can use their judgment to make this decision. But we especially encourage reports if the event led to a hospitalization or disability. It isn't necessary to report a mild, well-characterized adverse event like some injection site pain, you know, especially if it resolves and doesn't cause great concern. But these types of events may be reported if the clinician chooses to do so.
So when in doubt, report.
Yeah, when in doubt, report.
Okay. Well, thank you, Karen. Vaccination, just to sum this up, vaccination is the best way to prevent influenza. And as clinicians, you play a vital role in vaccine safety by making sure your patients understand the potential risks and benefits of vaccination, that you screen for contraindications and precautions prior to vaccination, and that you promptly report adverse events after vaccination. Vaccine safety monitoring is a very important part of the annual influenza vaccination program, both to detect potential adverse events after vaccination and to maintain confidence in the vaccination program. I'd like to thank our panelists today, Dr. Uwecki and Dr. Broder, and thank you for joining us today for this Medscape Spotlight, real talk about influenza vaccine safety. Be informed, be prepared. We hope you find the information in this spotlight useful to you in your practice. And please take a moment to click on the Earn CME link to take the post-test and receive CME credit. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME Activity, Real Talk About Influenza Vaccine Safety. Be informed and be prepared. To participate in the CME activity, please go to cme.medscape.com/features/audio and select the title,